Here I am. Jim Sparks is on the way. Jim Sparks lives here in the Nevada desert. He works as a debt consultant. Born in 1954, he spent his early years in Florida. Sparks studied real estate at a community college in Florida, began working for a major condominium firm, who eventually moved him to Houston, Texas in 79. After 12 years, he began J&J Properties, a natural land development company, which mostly operated in North Carolina. Sparks was now able to use his own philosophy and forbid removing more trees than necessary on each lot. At 34 years of age, Sparks was happily married and financially successful when his experiences with other worldly beings started. Life as he knew it began to unravel with these unexplained incidents. Now, 18 years later, Sparks has moved from register to cooperator, make that resistor to cooperator, and is sharing his experiences with others. A conservationist at heart, Jim encourages others to support his work being done by the Nature Conservancy, that's a good group, to help save critical acreage in the Atlantic Forest region of South America. He's an amazing man. Actually, I tried to reach out and get him an hour early so we could spend more time with him, just because he's got such an extensive knowledge and memory, a very accurate memory of what happened to him. You'll begin to hear about it in a moment. Jim Sparks, welcome back to the program. Hello, Jim. Hello, Jim. Jim Sparks is not there at the moment. We'll hold and see what happens. Oh, how anticlimactic is that, huh? The big build-up, and then he's not there. Well, obviously, we'll try and get Jim back. However, let me tell you this while we're waiting. This man, above and beyond all other people, that maybe he's been abducted. My God. He is a many-time abductee. Now, while I don't think that's really the case, who knows? Jim Sparks is an amazing man. Of all the people we've had on who have been abducted, and God knows we've had many of them on this program, he is the most articulate, has the best memory of what occurred to him, and is able to relate to us so much knowledge about those who did abduct him. It's just absolutely amazing. We're going to try one more time. Jim Sparks, welcome to the program.
Oh, great. It's great to be here, Art. Thanks.
What happened?
I heard crackle, click, and it was gone.
I just heard another one.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, I know. Well, if it can, it will. Too.
All right. Well, all right, Jim, in order to, obviously, there are some out there who are not here for the first two programs we did. So while I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, I do want to sort of recap how this began for you and, you know, how it manifested. There will be a lot of new listeners tonight, I guarantee.
Okay. And it started for me in mid-'88. Excuse me, mid-'88. Prior to '88, I, as far as I was concerned, as I mentioned before, I didn't think anything like this could be. I didn't study the subject. I wasn't into the subject at all. And for myself, it was like dreamlike experiences. And I kept, in mid-'88, I kept having the same reoccurring dream that something or some things were coming into the bedroom, escorting me off the bed, out of the bedroom, down the hallway, and then we would get into the guest room area, and we had a ground level window, and they would walk me right through the window, go into the woods. Something would take place there. At that time, I had no memory of it. After crossing the lawn, and then they would bring me back the same way, and back down the hallway and into the bed again. And as I mentioned before, this just went over, it happened time and time again, and as far as I was concerned, it was just a dream. But one particular evening, the dream was extremely vivid, and after the experience was over, I had walked into the guest room, and I saw where my footprints were embedded in the lawn, And in, at that time in our lawn, we had thousands of these little, what I call honeysuckle flowers, draped across the lawn. And I could see a heel of 1 foot outside, and I could see the toes and the ball of my feet embedded in the carpet inside. Only there was a window right in the middle with the flowers and the grass and everything all spewed into the guest room. So that was the beginning stages of what I refer to as going the easy way, meaning that what I've learned over the years is when they're on the ground or the crafts are landed, they escort you via these little worker beans, and it's not so torquing on your system. That was their way, in a sense, of getting one accustomed to the fact that, hey, we're here, even though it was dreamlike at first, and then it became a conscious awareness totally, like face-to-face. And then there was the rude and abrupt, I don't know if I mentioned it this way before, introduction to what I call being taken the hard way. Excuse me, that I surmised was when crafts are in the air and they literally pull you from the ground, be it in your home or wherever you may be. Right. And that's when it's really rough on your system. I mean, really rough. First you hear a slow whirling, whipping sound that increases, and the RPM increases, and it gets louder and louder, and then you get a sensation in the pit of your stomach that starts working its way up to your chest, and then when it gets to your heart starts racing, I mean, just really fast, and you think you're going to die, and then there's this acceleration. A sense of as if you're on a roller coaster and you're going down instead of up. So the sensation always felt like I was being pulled down, only 100 times faster. And inside your mind, you're just screaming, "I don't want to die! I don't want to die!" And your heart's racing at 1,000 miles an hour, and then you black out.
Jim, let me just stop you there for 1 second. I've had a lot of people describe what you just said to me in much the same way, and I sort of wondered, as you were saying it, I wonder how many people they've attempted to abduct with a bad heart who then just had a heart attack and died, and, you know, it was ruled a natural death because what else could it be?
Well, I can't say that I've seen anything like that or experienced other people go through that and die, fortunately for me.
Well, right, we wouldn't know.
Because you're... Believe it or not, over the years you develop, you get accustomed to it, but still, even the first several years of it, there's a sensation throughout the whole thing that there's something about your system that tells you you're alive, and you know that if you let go of that, you're convinced you're gonna pass on.
Yes.
And that's the scariest part. So when your heart's racing like that and you're feeling that acceleration, and what's happening is where there's any mercy at all in it is the fact that you black out. Now, I've had others say, well, maybe that's because it's tremendous G-forces. I've had others say different reasons. But just before the point of blacking out, you're convinced that's it. I'm no longer going to be here. And then you're gone. It's black. And then when you open your eyes, you're sick. You're nauseous. You feel like you just went through that, right? And you went from point A to point B, and then when you're at point B, it takes a few moments, and then you start realizing yourself again, and then you're there.
Well, when you say you're there, what do you now remember about point B?
Point B, particularly in those days, for the first 6 years, was always the same place. It was a room on board. It was always the same room. I always found myself sitting at something that was like a bench. I was, for the most part, almost totally paralyzed. In front of me was something that looked like I called it a screen table, for lack of a better term, that there was a table in front of me, and it had a large screen on it. And then in front of that, there was a wall like 5-8 feet in front of me, which was another, on the wall was another screen. And as it turned out over the months and years, different images and different experiments and different things were conducted in that setting. But I was sitting up. The only thing that could move the majority of the time in those first 6 years were my head could go up and down slow, and my right arm and right forefinger were always propped on this table that I could move my right forefinger, and if I drew a vertical line or a horizontal line, it was like an Exa sketch, so to speak, and those images would appear either on that table or they would appear on the wall, depending on what they were doing. And that's how I found myself almost all the time the first 6 years. It was horrible.
They were trying to teach you things and get you to react in certain ways, and they actually began to apparently teach you an alphabet.
Correct. Yes, and that thing was, and as I mentioned before, I think what maybe made me different was the fact that right from the jump, I didn't want anything to do with it. I was filled with extreme anger, extreme hate, loathing was the minimum of how I felt for them. I didn't want to be there. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know why I was there. Everything was completely out of context. Here you are at home. The next thing you know, you go through this travel experience, and then wham, you're there. And they were, you know, right to the point, even on the first visit, so to speak, or the first abduction, or when I was pulled the first time, which is to convert letters, starting with A, to what I called some alien equivalent symbol. As the years progressed, I learned later feel that it was just the beginning stages of teaching humans how to be telepathic, which is to focus your thoughts and focus them into symbols, and you had to direct the symbols exactly, motion, direction, sound it out in your head, and it kind of stands to reason. I'm thinking one day, I feel like there will be telepathy, I think will be common one day, even for us, and I feel like if your brain can transmit or radiates energy, and it's scattered energy, and if you can just not necessarily focus the energy at an object, which would be another individual, as you being the transmitter and them being the receiver,
right,
but focus the energy in a symbol form, like a sentence or a thought, in just one symbol, and it's always doing the same thing. So let's say hypothetically, the symbol for open the door or on would be to do a circle in your mind, starting from the bottom, let's say, and go. And then, you know, one thing they didn't, God, I can go on with that, but you didn't do the conventional methods of transcribing letters and symbols. You had to start at different points, ending points, or the middle of a normal letter where it would be. I guess so your mind is learning something different, even though you're familiar with stuff. And so you would have a strong circle in your mind. And so it would be easier for something, a receiver, to pick up something that's like a circle versus a scattered thought of turn on something. And so each one of these symbols meant something. Each one was strong. And each of them can be picked up. And that symbols, after many years of those early years, they're 100% telepathic, and they normally would communicate with you where you can hear what they're saying in your head, but they wanted me to rely more on what they were showing me versus how they would just naturally do it. And it, over the time, it learned a whole different alphabet, so to speak, in telepathy with them, and we communicated back and forth that way.
Okay, there are many symbol-like languages on Earth. Is there any analogy you can come up with? What did these symbols look like? Obviously, the early ones were very simple, circles or something else. But when you really got to what you call their alphabet, can you describe what the symbols were like?
Yeah. Sometimes folks will come up and they'll have a piece of paper and they'll say, does this look familiar to you? Or have you ever seen anything like this? Or this is ancient from 2,000 years ago. And I'll look. And there's something common. What I've learned about the symbols is that they're more like squiggly lines, and that the pen or the pen in the mind, so to speak, isn't ever lifted. So everything's like a solid, primarily. Primarily you draw from the bottom. You go from right to left. And, for example, let's say hello, how are you is a shorthand, like a Craig shorthand in a sense. I'm not saying I'm real familiar with Craig shorthand because somebody brought up that term and said this is sort of like that. But hi, how are you is this like little short squiggly thing. And then "Hi, how are you?" becomes shortened by, or the term "Hi, how are you?" would be shortened even smaller to where it's almost a dot. So your finger is vibrating, and that's why my forefinger would be allowed to be on that table. "Hi, how are you?" And it would get to the point where my finger would, every time, like I'm talking to you right now, my right forefinger would vibrate in the exact directions and motion without me thinking about it anymore, to where our words and thoughts are transformed into that symbolic form. So now my finger is doing it as I'm speaking. What I learned, and I'm glad you asked me this, as time went on, your body naturally would even vibrate to that. And as I speak to you right now, as I'm talking to you, my right forefinger's on the table, so to speak, and it's moving in the direction of the symbols that I learned. Your body vibrates that, and you're vibrating thoughts physically, and then they're picked up. So the way it worked was, here's what is really where it went to something that just astounded me. It's particularly the first day when I realized what was going on with it. I was just like floored. They had taken several pages of normal written text for me to read. And I was reading the text, and it was about a friend, somebody I knew, where he was born, what his likes were, what his dislikes were, what his childhood was like, what schools he went to, and when he got married. And it's just a buddy of mine, and I'm reading about a buddy page after page, and I'm thinking, why are you having me do this? And that was several pages of text. Then presented before me was one page of that new symbol form that we had learned, and it was like a half a page or less than a half a page. So the whole 20 pages of text was now reduced to a half a page, and I could read the symbols, and I was going, oh, my God, I can actually read these symbols, and I, yes, I'm getting this story. Now, the next thing that was presented, which really floored me, was they presented something about the size of between the size of a quarter and a 50-cent piece, and it had the shorthand version in squigglies, and they were vibrating inside this coin, so that when they flashed the coin in front of my face, I say a coin, but it wasn't, it was just this circle thing, I got the whole story like instantaneously. It's like, wow. And the best way I could describe that would be if someone were to say to you just a simple term, Old Yeller. Now, what we're capable of is, you remember the movie, right?
Of course. Back, and we all cried, yes.
Yeah. And so everything about that movie, everything that went place, flashes before you, and you got the whole movie in an instant. Huh. And it's the same thing with that type of communication. So you could see these symbols, and the symbol would contain the whole story, only an extremely shortened version, and you'd have it in a matter of seconds. So it went from what I thought was pure torture. Learned A, B, C, and converted over, and I didn't want to do it. And then
actually, some of it was torture. In other words, in order to teach you, particularly at an early stage when you didn't want to learn, they virtually did torture you, didn't they?
It was punishment and reward, no doubt. Punishment would be they would increase the levels of pressure, air pressure in the room. So, and I was pretty much the same, I was pretty predictable. No, I wasn't going to do anything. Every time I was there, I did everything in my power, anything in my ability to fight them tooth and nail. I wasn't going to cooperate in any way, shape, or form. If I can mess up any plan, if I can mess up any experiment, and it leads me to believe it's probably why I remember a lot, because all I was doing was scrapping with them. And but if they wanted me to get a letter or to convert a letter to a symbol, and I said no, as I usually would, there would be a thumping sound, a woofing sound, like poop. And then the air pressure would increase in the room at a short jolt, and it would, ouch, be painful, right? And then they would increase the levels. I go, no, you can't get me to do that. And it would be stronger, it would be louder, and then the levels would steady increase until it was just not worth resisting anymore, and then I would squiggle the line. And but then on the other side of the coin, there would be reward sessions, and it was based on punishment and reward.
The reward. And what was the reward?
You could, for the most part, as I mentioned earlier, they do not like questions. That's something I learned about their nature, and over the years, I just don't. If they want you to know something, they'll let you know. If not, you're just not going to know unless they want you to. So asking questions is like a big no-no, an extreme annoyance, so you don't. But early on, I was always calling them things, and I made names up for them that, cuss words that never existed for them. And
I can imagine.
Yeah. But however, if you did ask a question and they did answer it and it was not time for them to answer, they would always answer in riddles. And it would
hold it right there, Jim. Hold it right there. We've got a break. We're out of break. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast. Once again, Jim Sparks. So, pain and pleasure to teach, much as you would teach a puppy or something. Jim, when you got a reward, was it always the answer to a question, or were there other methods of reward?
Well, in the early years, I foregoed, I guess, if that's the proper term, or I would pass on a lot of the what was offered in the reward sessions because I didn't, my take at the time was, I don't want anything from you. I don't care what it is, even if it's pleasurable or even if it's knowledge. And for a long time, I wouldn't even accept any of the reward sessions. But as time went on, I realized that if I wanted to get out of there, the more I cooperated and then would have a reward session, the quicker I would get home. So mm-hmm. That conditioning worked, but it took a long time. I would rarely get a questions answered. There would be something that they do too, which would be sexual energy.
Yeah, I had a feeling that's where you were going.
Yeah, euphoria. They can, as science fiction as all this sounds or has sounded, but they can take any kind of human energy and store it, be it hate, be it love, be it euphoria, be it whatever it may be. I suspect that over time that what they do with a lot of that is barter with it. I think when they travel, so to speak, if you have a person that has this air about them of leadership and they just have this magnetic personality and you want to follow every word he or she may say, I think that they can offer those sensations, which can be commercially extremely productive. I think that when they deal and barter with different individuals, be it someone who's in power, someone who may be in the military, someone who may be whatever it is that they're trying to gain, it's something that they can use as chips or playing chips, so to speak.
Boy, that's logical. Probably in our own future. Michael in Boulder, Colorado, fast blast me a good one. He says, I just finished reading Mr. Sparks' new book, and I've got a question. Does Jim know enough about the number system and the alien alphabet that he could actually teach this to others, or is there so much of an unknown psychic component to the whole teaching bit that he can't?
That's a good question, and actually, there has to be, for the most part, their presence to make sense out of a lot of this. And it is, one can say, a psychic presence, too, just their psyche, because their minds are such that their thoughts are radiated, and they can screen image where you can see things that may be in your mind, and then it's transmitted in a holographic form, which looks like it's hanging in the air, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And they are in a dimension instead of just a flat surface. A lot of it takes on dimension, and when they're there, it activates that. But not necessarily all of it, but a big part of it is that way. I feel that in relating to you or to me or to others where we could use it, in essence, at this point, because as we discussed in the last show, I was mentioning that you said that you were into communicating with the dots and dashes and Morse code, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and you would pick up to the point where you wouldn't even have to write it down. You know what the sequence is, and you hear the words in your mind, and then you're carrying on a conversation almost like normal. And it's
Jim, it's still true. After all these years, it's still true.
And certain symbols are like that, so that you pick up, you know that when you see the images of symbols in your mind, you know what the meaning is. And the, but the whole the primary idea behind it, I believe, is once the experts get their hands on this stuff, and they could probably make good use of it, you're not only telepathically communicating, but you're also doing it in a way in symbolic form, where, as I was mentioning earlier in the show, that you can get 20 texts of information as a person, and that data comes in as a stream, and then you understand it within a split second.
Okay, so you feel you could teach this to somebody?
Yes, to a certain degree, the elementary form, sure, because
all right.
There's standards that stay that hold strict discipline, so to speak. And areas there that are standard, and once you pick them up, I believe so, yes.
Okay.
I'm waiting for the time, I guess, Art, for these things that I've picked up and these things that I've learned, and it seems like different situations come up and the timing is right, and I present something, and it's the right people or the right persons or the right person at the right time, and it's something that maybe they've been studying for years, and then it gives them answers to things that they haven't been able to find, and things start coming together. So I feel like a lot of this, and I've seen it over the years, it's just a matter of me being at the right place at the right time with the right people, and it gels.
All right. Your contact was primarily with what we know as the grays and the reptilians, yes?
Yeah, 95% gray, I would say 3-5%. Reptilian and on rare occasions humanoid beings, and it wasn't uncommon with the gray contact in that 95% scenario for there to be military individuals, and making it very plain that that's what they were, and I could see them and interact many times over.
Okay, Jim, you make note of the nature and personality of the grays and the reptilians, for that matter. I'm very interested in that. You detected differences, in other words, in the grays themselves. You were able to discern individual personalities.
I think what most abductees deal with are the worker beings, and they don't have much of a personality, if any at all, because they're part robotic and they're part biological. So they react and interact in that manner. And I think the big part of the times people spend as an abductee is with those guys, or those beings, or those things, or the worker beings. Then there's definitely a distinct difference between them and what I call, for lack of better terms, true aliens, meaning that they're the real McCoy. They're the ones that create these beings. There's the reptilians, or what are commonly referred to as reptilians, they have they're the ones with personality. They're the ones with emotions, feelings. They slow way down to communicate, whereas on the part of the grays, they pretty much don't have emotion, or they don't come across with emotion. But there is ways to distinguish one individual from another, and it's an energy they radiate. I learned that in a lot of uncomfortable ways over the years, but now I'm used to it, that you could be in the room, let's say, with two grays, and they're radiating this energy, and you sense it, because usually the energy is not a comfortable one, because after all, it's coming from it's not of this world. It's something.
So what are you discerning, Jim? Are you discerning the level of the energy you're getting from them, or the nature of it?
I would say both, because I could tell that when an authority, be it by rank or be it by whatever authority the particular gray is in, what emanates out of that individual is more powerful than what emanates out of maybe one with lesser authority. For example, there would be times, and this just happened haphazardly, or it would seem haphazardly, but I started seeing a pattern, whether I was supposed to or not, where a big part of the work that they did with me in the early years was with this that table I said was in front of me. It was artificial intelligence, and this is 19 years ago. I don't know what we were doing with that then. It could read your thoughts. It could interact with you. It would teach you. I called it a teaching machine. It would teach you the how to transcribe or change the R letters to their letters, and a lot of the experiments went on with this machine. If I was highly uncooperative, which I was a lot, but let's say where the machine couldn't control what it wanted to do with me, then worker beings would come in and give it a shot. If it didn't work with them, then, see, I started seeing these levels. You see where I'm coming from with this?
Yes, I do.
And then if I was even more stubborn and fighting tooth and nail, a true alien would come into the room. Now, when a true alien, what I call a true alien or a true gray, comes into the room, they radiate an energy, and I had mentioned earlier, that's not comfortable. It's miserably uncomfortable.
No, let me discern here. You say a true alien, or a, you said, true gray. So it would still be what we classically, and I think most of the audience listens to this program knows what a gray is, but they would still essentially look like the classic gray, but you'd be very obviously aware you're dealing with a higher intelligence.
So they're physically they're physically a little bit different too, Art.
Oh, okay.
They're a foot or two taller.
Oh.
Their eyes are not as big as the worker beings. So the worker beings have the real big eyes. You know, you heard me say before, I feel like the eyes are on the worker beings are any kind of, they're that large to get any kind of light or any kind of stimuli, I think, energizes them. I think it's a purpose for the big eyes. But the grays themselves, yes, their eyes are bigger, definitely bigger than ours, but they're not as big as the worker beings, the giant almond-shaped eyes. They're a little bit taller, and their skin is leather-like. And you can make out what appears to be maybe wrinkles. So you can distinguish a little bit of difference from one to another.
All right, so then obviously it follows that these worker grays were made in the image of, but
yeah,
not...
Yeah, you got it.
Right?
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah, let us make them in our image sort of thing. So there are some funny sides, and that is a funny side. That's kind of hysterical. But I've seen also the worker beings with human beings doing tasks for them. I've seen them with... they accompany reptilians, and they also accompany gray. So this is some sort of almost a commodity, or it's literally what they are. They run tasks for you, and you program them however they program them, and they do it. So they're part biological and part robotic. But now there's rank and order within the grays. And as a human being, the way you determine who has a higher rank is discerned by that energy again, for lack of a better term, that's radiated from the being. And the more powerful that energy is, the more it overwhelms you, and then if they bring in high enough rank, so to speak, then no matter how you fight, you're going to give in. If the worker beings couldn't get control of me, then a gray would come into the room. They would be radiating an energy. I would be again paralyzed at this bench, and they would lean over, or he would. I always refer most of them as he's. That's just something I sense. He or it would lean over my head and be staring into my head, and then project images, thoughts of cooperating, and it would be something you would be fighting, and at times I would be so angry I could resist it, and in those cases another one would come into the room, but then you would sense his presence or its presence several feet away. I mean, it could be 20 feet, 30 feet away, and as this being started getting closer, now you're just, everything's dumping from your head into your system, and you're broke down completely, and it leans over your head and you just do.
Jim, when these so-called real aliens, the grays that emanated the greater energy, would deal with you, could you at that point begin to discern some sort of personality, some sort of emotion, some sort of difference that was marked?
The closest thing to emotion, and now see, this took years and years and years, the closest sense to emotion that I could pick up in the early years, the first sense would be an emotion of cynicism. The highest compliments that I ever got paid, which to me were almost like feelings for these guys, were two things that were said to me. One was, "You're a friend." And then the other one was, "You understand us."
Mm-hmm.
And in all the interactions that you have with the Grays, they're just cut, dry, bland, and you just get no sense of feeling at all. And of course, it always annoyed me. Now, the worker beans, on the other hand, I used to mess with them because I sensed that they were part, the material that they were using or the raw material was derived from us to make these worker beans other than the robotic parts. So I don't mean to sound scary here, but... And if I had mentioned earlier, if there was 360 degrees, and each degree was thousands of millions of bits of data and agenda on their part, I was savvy to, you know, one or two degrees in this whole 19 years. And one of them was with this intimacy with the worker bean type. So on one occasion, I always tried to get some kind of an emotional or a response of self awareness out of them, like the self-realize that they exist. And the closest that I had ever came was there were lots of times when I said I was paralyzed a lot, I could always yell and scream until they just got sick of hearing it, and for whatever reason they then paralyzed my vocal cords. And I would yell and scream different things at them. I would call them different things. But on one particular session, I said, "You're the most pathetic, lowest forms of life. You have no feelings, you don't care, and you don't even know you exist." And both of them stopped. I got two of them to stop on their tracks.
"And you don't even know you exist."
"You don't even know you exist." And I'm sorry, Art, let me get a sip of water here.
No, that's right. Maybe you hit them right square between the big eyes.
Low humidity in the desert.
Uh-huh.
Nonetheless, that there was a moment where two of them stopped on their tracks that I can remember vividly in the last 19 years. It had captured their attention, and I could see that they were, for the first time, looking within themselves as if, "Am I something?" And
do
then,
"I exist?" Yeah.
"Do I exist?" And what happened afterwards told me I was getting somewhere, because a true alien or a gray came into the room. Because he could somehow sense that they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, because I had them stopped in their feet.
Yeah.
And he said, and his words were maybe not proper English, "Don't say that to them. Don't say that to them." And then, the sensation of guilt came over me as if, okay, so I'm making something aware that it's aware. And not
like you had mistreated a dog or something.
Yeah, right. "Don't say that to them." And then they went on doing their normal thing. So, rank and file. So, like in the military. So, they radiate an air, an energy that's uncomfortable. It's overbearing. It's extremely powerful. And see, now these guys aren't talking. They're telepathic, and they radiate this stuff. So that lends one to understand the difference between who has more power, who has more rank, and who has more authority.
Sure. Okay, that could definitely be classified in the dislike area, something they disliked or they were uncomfortable with. Were you able to ever figure out anything they liked?
Yeah, over time, they had very peculiar... There were some things that just, well, I mean, does any of this really make real sense? But yes, a lot of it starts to make sense over time. But there were things about, I guess you can say, it started off with me during different sessions with me interacting with particular scenarios like war. So they would...
War.
War.
They like war?
They have an interest in how we see war, how we feel about war, how we think about war, and over time... It was an area that I think that they just had a fondness in learning about.
Hold tight, Jim. Boy, time is flying. I'm Art Bell. Once again, Jim Sparks. Jim, any idea what it was about war that fascinated them?
I think a lot of it had to do is because throughout history we're always doing it. And so there would be many, 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 many thousands of holograms or interaction and communicating with scenes of war from tens of thousands of years ago, even longer, to present-day war. They're enthralled with it, and then they're also seem to be enthralled with we as humans as to what we see in it by constantly showing me different scenes, and getting my reaction to it. There are some things that something that came to mind when I said that if there's an emotion at all, it would be like a cynical or cynicism.
Yes.
Something that was kind of funny that happened. The funniest, I guess you could call it a joke on their part. After 19 years, the only quote-unquote closest thing to a joke was I had done particularly super well in one training session, and so I knew that I could ask a question when it was time for the reward session. So my question was, it wasn't funny to me at first, but I think back and I laugh about it. I said, and I thought it was a good question. What is faster than light? Right? Okay.
Yes.
So that what appeared in a hologram form was a hologram or picture of my face and a musket rifle to the right of my head, and then a musket rifle to the left of my head at a 45-degree angle where the muzzle was the two muzzles were close to my head, and then the firing mechanism had just went off, and the musket balls were about to blast me, so to speak. And then the telepathic which was cynicism. It was meant to be a joke. It wasn't funny to me at the time, but I reflect back at it now, was what would hope would be faster than the speed of light would be you not being here anymore because of all the trouble that you've given us. And I just, at the time, I didn't think it was funny. I said, man, I can't believe it. You know, you put me through all this, you traumatized me, all this stuff, and you think this is funny. But over the years, now I reflect back on that, and it's pretty humorous.
Did you ever get any answers that you can relate to us that will tell us anything about them, where they're from, what their motivations are, what they want, and why they're here?
Well, they're just not forthcoming about where they're from. And over the years, why they're here, well, that's a different thing. But over the years, what I've picked up is the fact that the foundation of where you're from would be like what we relate to, like we're from a place. We're from either a planet or we're from, if you want to go deeper, or we're from this dimension, so to speak. And these guys, they live so long. They may live thousands, they may live tens of thousands of years. They may never even really die and go from one maybe cubicle body to the next because the technology is such. So where they're from relative to traveling time, relative to traveling dimensions, relative to being from one physical plane to the other, what similarities are there, where the law of physics apply there, they don't hear, and so on and so forth, is over the millenniums. In essence, they're not really from one particular place, is what I'm picking up. So they're not really forthcoming with that answer. So I've learned, will I one day, perhaps? Again, I've learned, Art, that they don't like questions, and it's always the same questions, and I can see why, because whenever people are abducted, or just more than myself, or a mass abduction, and there is some brief moments of conscious interaction, it's always the same thing. Who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here? And on and on and on. That's all they hear. That's all they've been hearing for thousands of years. So they cut themselves off to it. But they aren't infatuated by this business with war. And then things that really threw me off that I didn't expect, which was hats from thousands and thousands of years ago and that we wore hats in fashion, police hats, military hats, caps, hats with feathers, hats, and head covering. And so they focus on hats. And
maybe they think it has something to do with our brains, natural extension from our heads, right?
Well, they have asked at times where is your hat? Well, why don't you wear a hat? And I just don't wear a hat. You know, mm-hmm. So not that I. Every now and then I'll throw a baseball cap on or something if I don't feel like shaving or something. I got to run some errands on a day off. But I mean, that's about it. So there's a fascination with hats, uniforms.
That is interesting. Now you've described the grays, the various grays, very well to us, and in a way I've never heard before. What about the reptilians? Could you actually physically describe a reptilian?
There's different type. There's one type that is huge. They look like the size of linebackers. They're extremely broad-chested and broad-shouldered. Their skin is scaly, but their heads are what distinguishes them from the other. Not so much how their face would look, so much as to what protrudes out of their foreheads. The top of their heads and their foreheads, where I guess the cognitive and maybe the higher thinking is,
mm-hmm.
jets out different from others, meaning that their brow can be hanging almost misshapen and hideous. Okay, so your first glance at this, it would literally scare you, maybe even scare you to death. But over time, you realize that these guys are the ones with feelings. These are the ones with emotions. They're the ones that will go through the trouble of explaining what's going on with the planet, what's going on with the Earth, what's going on with the environment, what they've been trying to accomplish with leaders and so forth, and now the average person, which I just consider myself the average person. But they're physically, their heads are misshapen on the forehead part, where it's just their brains are extended out, and it's almost as if the outer shell is protects the brain like it would us, but however they are raised or they grow, there's more freedom for that part of the brain to jet out or extend out, which I think perhaps might even give them better intelligence capabilities. Then there's this other type that they look more like a snake or a lizard. Their size, they stand up. Their size is more like ours. Their face is shaped snake-like or lizard-like. And they seem to have more of a right-to-the-point, business-like attitude. And I've even picked up a cynical sense of humor from them.
All right. Would there be a way, Jim, that you could describe the reptilians' relationship to the real grays? Would you describe it as their allies, or would you say the reptilians are the bosses and running the show and directing even the real grays?
From what I could see and from what I've experienced, the latter of what you just said, which is I don't see them as allies, but I see them as directing them. And see, I was in the hands of the grays for many years before I'd have these short excursion interactions with the reptilians. So it was the grays that basically taught this human, this untamed wild one, to behave. And so whenever I'm in the presence of any of these, I'm not paralyzed like I was before, and I don't make trouble. I know how to act. I know just to stand there. I know to listen. I know not to move quick. I know not to make any signs of aggression, and most of all, not ask questions.
Yeah.
And so I know how to behave, and all of that came from interaction with the grays. So it led me to believe that. Plus, there was been interactions where, when they explained that. That they've given technology, and some of the stuff is just so simple, Art. I mean, it's like it's easy stuff. We gave in technology to provide energy needs, to provide different needs that people need to leaders, and they've turned around and made money with it and weapons with it. And the primary push here as of late would be to make contact with individuals like myself and others around the planet. I think that that inevitably it'll reach the point of critical mass. Abductions have been done, and mass abductions over the years, and involving hundreds, if not thousands, of people all in one swoop, getting environmental lessons. And like that, the gentleman that I had mentioned to you before, the one I had saw on board on the last show,
right,
where I mentioned someone's name, and I got to see him in a environmental abduction, so to speak, getting environmental lessons, and to watch this person flower and what he is with all his talents and all his resources, and to watch that flower into something very powerful for the rainforest and the environment, and all the power and the resources that he has to put it to use for that, and just knowing where the seed, you know, for that stuff was planted from. So, you know, there's positive, you know, those positive aspects. So I know that the reptilians get the bad rap, because a lot of stories I hear, unfortunately, are the rape stories, or they do this and they do that. Other people tell me that. And that's, in my experience, I haven't seen anything like that. The cold ones are the grays, and the ones that seem more human-like are the reptilians.
And do you think that, and of course we hear, I hear so many abduction stories, Jim. Do you think the majority of people never, in effect, graduate from the grays to the point where they see the reptilians? In other words, they may be abducted for whatever purpose and then returned and never have another experience.
I get, I'm really unique in that respect, and it's not that I want to be. I've just found myself, Art, in these different scenarios. Even when the reptilians, the technology they use to get you from point A to point B is different from what the grays use. It's much easier on your system. It's much gentle, much more gentle. When you go from point A to point B, you're not sick for several minutes when you're there. So even the technology they use is a bit different. So perhaps, but see, what I've learned about the thing with the grays is a lot of memory is lost because it's so traumatic, number one, that you don't want to remember it. And it was for me, and it really, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, and I'm not claiming to embrace alien culture, because I have a healthy suspicion about all of them all the time, and not that to the point of silliness, but a guarded, healthy to protect myself. And I know that it's taken years to just to get my physical self and emotional and mental self used to the energy that radiates out of some of these guys, that when they get close enough, you'll black out. And when you black out, you lose a lot of memory. And a lot of experiences when I've seen mass abductions with other human beings, and there are individuals who are carrying on fully conscious during the experience, I see the memories taken away towards the end. I see them blacking out towards the end, and they don't remember a lot of it. And a lot of it, maybe it's better they don't.
Why do you think you did remember it?
Anger and hate.
Anger and hate?
Anger, hate, and loathing. I knew I was okay. I knew what was happening was real. I knew that they had invaded at the time. That's the way I felt about it. They had invaded my life without invitation, without asking, without warning, and it so disrupted my life that each and every abduction scenario that I just hung on to such hate and loathing and anger that any chance that I could in those early years to break free, I was going to kill one, or as many as I could. So I was constantly angry. I was constantly hateful. I was constantly disruptive. Anything that experiment, anything that they could come up with, I was constantly fighting. And so I just hung on to that as a frame of reference for myself in those early years. And I think it forced a memory. I think also because of the way I carried on, I guess it was a, you know, that's not really that specially unique, but I guess it was for me to them. And I perhaps I became something like a favorite pet, so to speak.
Okay, I get a lot of calls from people who have been abducted. Fear is a very common reaction for any abduction, almost totally common. If you were to give advice to anybody who's been abducted, scared the hell out of them, and they fear it happening again, and if it happens again, what kind of techniques would you recommend to people to overcome fear?
Well, the MO is definitely fear, isolation, and confusion. In the beginning, particularly in the beginning of these things, isolated by the fact that, fear by the fact that there are otherworldly beings, isolation by the fact that what you have to say and share with other people or sound impossible to believe, and then confusion, of course, would be, where am I, why am I here, and I have no clue.
Yeah, of course.
The best way, I think, to get over the fear factor, without a doubt, is just always to know. And it has been in every case that I've seen, and including myself, of course, is always to know that you're not going to die, that you will go home. You will always make it through the experience. And any awkward and weird and queer feelings or the energies that's being radiated, make yourself feel better by knowing that the reason you're feeling that way is because, after all, these are energies and feelings from another world. They're not from here, and that won't kill you either.
Although you did say you saw some military people.
Yeah.
At times, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now that opens up a whole other area. Were you able to identify who's military? Were they U.S.?
Yeah, definitely U.S. So I was privy to United States military, and also from time to time I saw what I thought was military from Central and South America, which was much rarer.
Did you? Well, all right. If you saw U.S. military, I would think that under those conditions you'd immediately try to communicate, hey, soldier.
What are you doing? Why are you here? And what's going on?
Yeah,
I've been pulled. For example, there was a I don't know if I shared it on your show the last time, and maybe if I did, you'll remember. Where I've had experiences where I was when I say pulled, abducted to above ground and underground facilities, and one in particular that I can relate with your question to would be I found myself. In a hangar. Did I talk about that hangar in Nevada?
You did mention a hangar, yes.
And I could see inside this hangar what looked like military police. But there was the one individual that was an officer, and I was left to be as if I were drugged. I was half paralyzed. I was able to move very slowly. I couldn't think that fast, so I guess I couldn't just jump off the gurney and make trouble. And that particular individual, for whatever reason, took an interest in the way I was interacting in that particular scenario. And he was talking to me as if like a father to son like type, and he asked me to read a book.
Hold it right there. Damn it. We're at another break. We'll get right back to this. Jim Sparks is my guest from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. Art Bell and Jim Sparks, both from the high desert. Jim's on the other side of the hill. Good morning, everybody. If this is not fascinating stuff, then then don't say you love me. We'll be right back. Having lived in a number of foreign countries, you know, I can tell you when you see another American, almost inevitably Americans, you know, grab and shake hands and how you doing, buddy, and where are you from, and, you know, you talk about home. Now, in the environment you were in, Jim, I can imagine if you saw, for example, an American military officer, if you were fully in possession of your senses, which you might not have been, you'd kind of have that reaction. My God, you're an American. Come on, what the hell's going on here? That kind of deal.
Sure. Well, Ed, in that particular scenario, I found myself on a gurney and I was in a hangar, and as I mentioned before, I knew I was in Nevada, and the military police or the military guards, I could see them with their backs up against the walls of the inside of the hangar with firearms on their side, and but I could see this one individual who was in uniform, and he was in officer uniform working with a gray, and they were working on some kind of, I think it was some sort of teleportation device. My trauma at that was the fact that they had some young woman in one of the spheres or cubes, or it was like a cylinder, I mean. And I sensed that she was in danger, and I had gotten off this gurney that was at the center of the floor to try and help her. And how I was going to help her, I don't know. I was in slow motion. But as I approached and I grabbed inside the cylinder to pull her out of it, it had no glass or walls or anything of that nature. It was really weird, and there was like a metal thing on top of it, and what suspended it from the floor and not dropping, I don't know, when she was inside of it. There was an empty one where I think I may have come from, and I think what they were showing us, or where they were teaching some sort of some technology for a transport system. But I was upset about the whole thing, and I tried to pull her out, and then I was subdued by the guards, and I was subdued by him, just cutting it short. But then I blacked out. When I came to, he was standing over the gurney looking at me as if he felt sorry for me. So there was compassion from this guy. And he said, "We're doing what we're doing because we have to." He says, "I know that this is difficult for you to understand." And he mentioned to read a section in a book to me. And now I'm half out of it, like you said, and half out of it and half yeah. there. And I remembered the name of the book, and then he told me the name of the author.
What was it?
It was called The Roman, and the author had this real long, peculiar name, and a name that I couldn't remember. And so when I had gotten back, I was very resistant or scared to go to the library to see if this thing even existed. Mm-hmm. And about three or more weeks went by, and I finally brought myself to the library because it kept nagging at me and nagging at me and nagging at myself to do it. Don't be afraid. Go there and see if the book is there. So I went into the old-timey card catalog instead of going into the computer. And as I was flipping through the cards, I saw this book, The Roman, by this, and I'm sorry right now, I can't think of the author's last name. I'm not saying go out and read this book, because the book is not even related to ETs or anything, but the one part, and then my knees buckled, and I almost fainted, and I grabbed onto the desk, because I recognized this long, weird last name that this guy had told me, and so I said, okay, this is real. But what I had read, the part that he wanted me to read, was the fact that it was about about the first century Roman emperor who had a chef, a personal chef, of course, as he would, who requested an audience with Caesar, and the audience had to do with the fact that he was working with the utensils in the kitchen, and one of which the properties of steam were intriguing him to the fact that he felt that he could create an engine. Now we're talking about a steam engine 2,000 years ago.
Right.
That could grind the corn, grind the meal, and could also power the warships, and he was going into different ways that it could be used, that he was perfecting this. So Caesar said, "You're a genius," and raved on what he had done. And as soon as the man left the presence of Caesar, he ordered his soldiers to have him executed immediately. And one of Caesar's generals had asked, "Well, why are you doing that?" this guy after all this, and he said, "Because what would the slaves have to do? Think about what it would do to the economy. So the point I'm making with this kind of long, drawn-out thing is the fact that that part of the book was to show that, because I was kind of ticked that a lot of this technology isn't being used to help us, and it's still here 2,000 years ago, the mentality is the same as it is today, which is what's going to happen to the stock market? What's going to happen to this? What's going to happen to the economy if all this stuff is introduced? So that was the reason he had me read it. So there were some personal interactions like that from time to time with humans. But they kept their distance. They kept quiet. They wouldn't talk to me. And so there was very, very little interaction for the most part in almost any experience.
All right. There was a military experiment apparently called Half Here and Half There. What was that about?
That one was extremely fascinating to me. I was in my living room, and this one took place approximately 10 years ago or more.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in my living room, and I started hearing the normal sounds for that whirling, whipping sound that I was describing when you're pulled the hard way. The only difference was that it was in very low and very slow RPMs. So instead of me hearing it really fast and that sensation in my stomach coming up real quick and entering my heart and then that feeling of acceleration, it was happening very, very slow. Now, if you can picture this, I'm sitting, and this is where we're experimenting with this stuff, and at least we were then. I'm sure we got it down now. But at the time, I was sitting on the sofa, and I was sitting with my feet were on the carpet, and the peculiar part about that experience was the fact that it was all going in super, super slow motion, completely unlike it was when I get pulled. And so the whirling sound was slowly speeding up, and as I looked out, I could start, instead of me getting that the sensation of force, G-forces, I was still sitting on the sofa, but I could start seeing the wall in front of me in my living room started to slowly fade away, and then as the wall slowly faded away, I could see the inside of a facility. And as the facility started to become more solid and everything that was in my and we're doing this stuff, Art. We were doing this stuff 10 years ago. And for whatever reason, guys like me are the guinea pigs for the ETs or the guinea pigs for the military. It's like we're tagged and titled and we're their property and whatever they want to do, whatever they want to do. And who's going to believe you? And so now you have a subject that's been through all this ET stuff. Now you got these guys that are human beings, that are military individuals with other civilian researchers in league with them. And I found myself inside a facility. In the facility, I could see it was inside of what appeared to be again another hangar. They had makeshift walls or dividers inside the place with desks. I could see about six guys in laboratory coats, and I can see again a military officer. And when I showed up over there, I was sitting, this was what was really odd, was I was sitting on a gurney, and it was a cold metal gurney with my feet dangling. And as I was being transported from point A to point B like that, I could feel the carpet under my feet, and I could feel the softness of the sofa under my rump. And at the same time, when I was slowly being transported to this other place, I could feel the hard coldness of the table and my feet dangling in the air. I stayed there for just a few seconds. I saw the individual. Excuse me. That's better. I saw the individuals that were doing it. But the odd part was, even to this day, every one of the faces that I saw in that room, I knew.
You knew?
I knew, but I didn't know why I knew them. I knew every single one of those individuals. So as I was coming into that from the field that they pulled me from into that area from going from point A to point B, and as they were coming in clearer, I looked at a face and I said, hi, and I couldn't think of the name. And then I looked at another one, I know, and you are, and it was like the memory from each and every one of these individuals was gone. And I knew these people. I knew who the officer was. I knew who these people were in the lab coats. I knew that I had been working with them before.
Okay, so that previous abduction, a previous abduction where you had been wiped.
I think so.
Yeah.
And it's us. You know, it's clearly it was us. Now, what made that whole thing a success was they were elated. It had worked. Whatever it was they were doing, it had worked.
You mean you're sort of half memory?
I'm here. In other words, they were able to pull me from my living room another state in another part of the country, so they succeeded. So they were elated by it. And then they're telling me, congratulations, we did it. Congratulations. Now, I'm not fully mobile at this point, and I'm looking at faces that look familiar. They're elated by the fact it worked. And then they did the reverse to bring me back. So they were able to pull this individual from my living room to a facility God knows where. So,
Jim, let me ask you this. With what you just told me, with memory, for example, of faces, in knowing these people, for example, if you were to see them again today, you would probably say, I know you.
Yeah, I would.
Right, okay. There's got to be some concern, Jim, and I wonder if you are concerned. I mean, here you are speaking very, very publicly about all of this, and no doubt people that are still alive and probably or possibly still in these programs, you're starting to tell an awful lot. So.
I know, Art, and I know that everything I say and everything I do and the experiences that I have, I'm being allowed to do this. So it's clearly things this sensitive would be extremely dangerous. Excuse
yes.
Me.
Yeah, exactly. Have you been contacted at all by anybody who didn't pull you out of your room to contact you? And by that I mean any knock on the door, any telephone calls, any warnings?
I worked with a guy. I'm telling you yourself and the many people with your show, and I won't mention names and I won't mention what company and I won't mention any of that. That I'll be still sick because I promise not to share this, but I worked with for 6 months a rather large defense contractor regarding these experiences. And these guys.
Oh.
Yeah. These guys were not related to any of the interactions that I've had with human beings that I've seen or any of the military people that I've seen. And so for half a year, I worked with a particular company, which,
I was. You?
I'm sorry?
They came to you?
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I was speaking at a conference, and the individual who played a big part in that company came to me and talked to me. And so he was extremely interested in what I had to say and the experiences that I went through and a lot of the details. And so worked closely with this guy for right at 6 months. This was several years ago. And so now, you like a person, me like a person. You notice I don't hold back on a lot of the things that I experience.
Right.
But if someone that specifically says, promise me you won't, I don't care if you say what I'm saying now, and rarely do I even talk about this. And I said, yeah, I agreed to do that. So, but that has happened that way, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was there information flow that went in both directions when you were employed by this defense contractor?
I felt like they were definitely out of the circle as far as, like, because I've divided what I call the government in three different categories. There's the government that we deal with at face value. That's the government we see every day.
Right.
99% of those guys and women, you know, really don't have any clue about any of this, and they can't be held liable or responsible for it because they don't. Then you have the second government that I jokingly call it the BBB, the Black Budget Boys. Okay. So the second government would fall in line with this defense contractor. They have things like crashed disks, debris from ET technologies, bits and pieces, maybe an alien captured and things of that nature. And they think that they're on top of all of this stuff, that they're it, this is it, we're the top secret guys, and we have it. And then there's that third area that is the really deep ops, black ops, that are have direct face-to-face interaction every day, every night stuff, and they're doing things together that even the second one has no clue that's going on. So so I have had interaction to the door, so to speak, with the second group, and, of course, I've found myself in abduction scenarios that involved the, you know, the real black op guys. So this would fall in line with this gentleman and his company would fall in line with the second group.
Why do you think you're being allowed to say this stuff?
Well, I thought over the years that when it came to the Grays in that first 6-year period, and I feel I'm always not afraid because I know that people are discredited.
Oh, sure.
Or they lose their background, or they get terminally ill and die, mm-hmm. and things of that nature. And what the big play is for this individual, which is myself, interacting with all of this and being able to just speak freely about it without any recourse, is beyond my understanding. With the exception of this, there's a the reptilians, okay, you got the Grays and so forth, and they want to see, along with the reptilians, they want to see a stop to the environmental woes of this planet. Then you've got there's an idea that the...
you would describe that as their main motivation for contact?
I would say for revealing their self, yes, and as you, the words you just put for contact, that where we can actually, that we know they exist. Because for tens of thousands of years, if not longer, they've been interacting with this planet and the people on this planet in secret with the vast majority not even aware that anything like this exists, and them not having an ego to really want to even be noticed. But when the environment that they're working in becomes hostile to them for various reasons, and particularly environmentally as one of them, then they want to do something about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, why do they care? And the answer is the environment, not for us, for them.
Exactly. And that's you got it right on the head.
Okay,
so,
well, but that begs the question, what do they want with our environment, i.e. our world?
Well, I mean, just a simple thing that I've noticed, again, if I said there was 360 degrees and agendas and there was several hundred agendas in each degree, I've been privy to one or two of those degrees, which is I know that they farm us, not to sound to scare you, or not you, but just to scare the public in general, but I know they do farm us for genetic material for various reasons. One is, as part of an agenda, is to create these worker beings that, you know, I was sharing with you later, which everybody knows is the big-headed, you know, big-eyed beings, mm-hmm. which are the half-robotic, but half, why they need the raw materials on a steady basis and why they would need it from here in particular, I don't know, but that's just a part of it. So, yeah, so there's an interest on their part, and us having to live on this planet creates an interest for us, so it works in that respect.
Okay. All right. Hold it right there, Jim. Jim Sparks is my guest, and I'm betting you've never heard, save the last show we did, anything like this at all. From the high desert, we both come. I'm Art Bell. I do want to take some calls, but in the interest of time, we've got a couple of other things to cover. Jim, the gift, something apparently extracted from your lungs?
Yeah.
What happened?
There was an experience. On occasion, there would be some, I don't know, medical fringe benefits, I guess. Very rare, though. It was extremely rare, but on one occasion... But I remember the procedure, and I found it fascinating too. I had woke up or became conscious. I was pulled. I blacked out during an experience, and I became conscious of of being on a gurney, and it was at a 45-degree angle, and it was tilted, and there was a medical procedure going on, and I could smell what smelled like mucus, the smell of mucus or saliva in my sinuses, and I felt it like my mouth was open, and it was coming out of my mouth like in almost like in vapor, and I can smell it through my nose. That was coming like the reverse of my lungs. And then I had blacked out again, and when I came to, I was in that room that I was telling you about that I spent the first 6 years in.
Right.
By the way, I should mention, you had mentioned earlier about, you know, I can say things without the recourse. Well, the first 6 years wasn't like that at all, and I was normally severely punished those first 6 years if I talked about things. And they were extremely strict about me not sharing anything the first 6 years, and which would be, I would get pulled, and the punishment would be that I would be completely ignored, paralyzed in my sitting in my little cubicle there for hours on end. So I would have pulling sessions where I would just sit there paralyzed for hours.
Who did you try to talk to?
Like when I would say something to family or friends.
Right.
Or if I would start writing symbols down, anything that I wasn't allowed to put pen to paper, pencil to paper. I wasn't supposed to talk about it, but see, I was stubborn and I was strong. And again, I fought him tooth and nail, and I put myself through a lot of torment with him because I just wasn't, again, anything that they wanted, I was going to do the reverse. So probably why it took 6 years before I was allowed any sense of freedom with him was because, you know, I was that difficult with him and that six-year period. So after 6 years, right almost to the month, I was told, go ahead and write a book. Write a book. And so I did. And that's where this all came about. So anyway, they, you know, we were kind of over there a little
while. Yeah, wait a minute.
Ago.
Hold it right there. Let's plug your book. We really need to do that. It's called The Keepers, An Alien Message for the Human Race. Very simple. The Keepers is the title. So go to Amazon and grab it. All the people who have fast blasted me, many since the last program, have absolutely loved the book, Jim.
Oh, great. Great. Oh, I'm supposed to tell you this, so I don't get in trouble, that there's an 800 number you can call to.
Fire away.
I'm not the advertising guy here, but anyway, it's 800-345-6665. So I'm supposed to say that
800.
Way of
no, I'll say it.
Okay.
Hey, here it is: 800-345-6665. There you go.
Thanks. Anyway, so yeah, those first 6 years, I wasn't supposed to talk, and they did, and it was severe punishment because just to sit in one spot like that for hours, paralyzed, was totally being ignored. Then you go home. So over time, you know, I learned. Again, the more I cooperated, the faster I got to leave. But and then at the end of that 6 year period, just things had changed so dramatically. One of which I was, you know, allowed to move around, and then I knew how to behave. I wasn't going to get hurt or kill anything. I knew not to ask a million questions. I just knew how to behave, and so that gave me the different privileges, so to speak. I know it sounds like the Helsinki. What is it? The Helsinki syndrome, where you're.
Yes.
But what can I say? It's like that. But anyway, on this one experience, I do remember coming conscious during a procedure, but I wasn't sure what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself standing in the room that I had been paralyzed in at that bench for 6 years, and I was leaning up against the table that was that table screen. And here I was in this room going, wow, I can move. I'm standing here. I'm by myself. What is this about? And through a corridor to the grays, the real ones, came walking into the room with one of them had a black box in his hands, holding it in front of him. And I would not look at the eyes too close, but I would stare at the ground, look at their eyes, stare at the ground, look at the eyes as they were coming up closer because it made me uncomfortable. And he took the black box and he set it on the table and he pushed it towards me. Mm-hmm. And I said, "What's this?" And they go, "It's a gift." I said, "A gift? Yes, it's a gift for you." And I said, "What the hell do you want me to do with it?" And the response was, "Do with it as you will. Do with it as you will." And then they turned around as they walked in, and they just walked out of the room. Now here I am by myself in this room with that screen on the wall and that table that I had been at for 6 years and the bench, and I'm looking at this box on this table, and it's just a square black box of absorbent black. It wasn't shiny black, and I'm looking at it, and I was wondering, well, I was kind of suspicious of it at first, and then I touched it and real quick and pulled my hand back, and it didn't shock me, and I was still alive, and nothing popped out of it. So then I picked it up, and I was holding it in my hand, and I was turning it upside down, sideways, flipping it around, and it all looked the same. So I figured, well, maybe it opened. So I took my hands, and I started pulling to see if I can get it to pull apart. After all, this was my gift, whatever the hell it was supposed to be. Pulling on it this way, and I'm pulling on it that way, and I couldn't get it to open. So then I took it, and I wedged it between my feet, and I was pulling like that, and I couldn't get it to go open. And then the telepathic voice said, "You haven't tried gently." Now, see, there was some moments here, you know. You haven't tried gently. Like, it was almost soft, right, like coming from a gray. Yeah, right, okay. But I went, yeah, I guess that's true. So I just gently put my hand over the box, and with little pressure, I pulled, and it opened up. And when it opened, I mean, this was a gift. It was this black, tarry substance in there, about, I don't know, 2-3 inches or more thick, with these glass tubes sticking in it. And it just stank to high heaven. It was just the most horrible smell. And I looked at it, and my face was close to it, and I pulled it back, and they came back into the room. I go, "What the hell is this? This is a gift? What kind of gift is this? This thing stinks." And they go, "What's your gift?" We extracted it from your lungs.
Oh, my God.
So I, smoked very heavy at the time, and so the gift was apparently clearing out my lungs.
Gee, as a 45-year smoker, send me a... You don't have that black box anymore.
I actually quit smoking for a while, and then now I'm smoking again. So I don't know if I'll get the gift the second time, but if I do, I'll certainly keep you in mind.
All right. Now, your experiences kind of tapered off, right?
Yes.
What about now? Do you still, on occasion, have contact?
Yeah, and it's not like it was. And one of my biggest gripes all those years was, why can't you guys be more like we are? Like, instead of, like, sucking me out of my living room or bedroom in the middle of the night and things of that nature, let me know you're here. So I've had I'd have a year where there may be just one. And then I'd have a year where there would be two or three experiences. And but it's the nature of the beast that makes it extremely difficult to interact with these guys. Do I have a few moments to go over that?
You do.
Okay, because there's just the things inherent to them that make it very difficult. Like I mentioned earlier, for starters, they radiate an energy that is extremely uncomfortable. So I'm like, I'll give the reasons why they don't basically knock on the door and say, "Can we have a cup of coffee with you?" They radiate an energy that's just miserably uncomfortable for human beings, and it takes a long time to adapt to it. They can scan your brain. There's no privacy, meaning that all of us are like this. There's things about us that we don't want other people to know about, something we may have done in the past, or something we don't want nobody to know. But when they communicate with you, you're raw. So there's the you at face value that everybody knows, and then there's this you inside that nobody's supposed to know about. So automatically, everything that's about you is known, and that's miserably uncomfortable. They have the ability to transmit thoughts 10 to 100 times faster. So now, I mean, that's rather intimidating. So now you've got a guy that radiates energy that makes you feel sick. You got a person that knows what you did when you were a little kid when you took the cookies out of the cookie jar and lied to your mom and said no.
Sure.
And then now he's going 10 to 100 times faster. And then, you know, they're completely telepathic. Then they have this ability to screen image. Screen imaging means...
Define screen image.
They can transmit a thought of theirs into your mind, and depending on how strong they want to mess with you, you either see what they're thinking and you think, hey, that's cool, I can see what they're thinking, or they could lead one to believe that that's reality. So people have been pulled over the years think that they're spending time with angels, or they think they're spending time with demons, or they met God, or things of that nature. They're extremely efficient beings. So whatever it takes to subdue the subject, the minimum resistance possible. So if you're inclined to believe in certain things, then they're going to play on those certain things, and it gets it over with. So now that's rather difficult. Now the technology they use is day and night different from us, but we're fast catching up with a lot of stuff, and I'm happy and pleased to see it. And the time travel thing is very real, but they do travel time. So traveling time to them is as simple as having a remote control and turning on television or turning television off. It's no big deal. In fact, what I'm finding out to them, because of the technology, what I'm finding out is it's almost almost boring to them to be somewhere maybe several hundred years or several thousand years back. And it's important to them to have these points, like Checkpoint Charlie, so to speak, where they can interact with something of familiarity, like a turf that they know at these different time points. But nonetheless, they travel time. I think we're very, very close to doing that now ourselves.
And, I hope we are.
Yeah.
Jim, did you ever ask any question about a supreme being?
I stay away from that like a sore thumb. Maybe it's because I may not like what I hear. And so my...
You mean you're staying away from answering my question?
Or both, or asking them. Because in the early years with interaction, they did try different techniques to force me to cooperate, one of which was they were screen imaging. And see the screen imaging I was referring to? The fact that they were angelic beings, okay, and I'm not cooperating with God, okay?
I see.
Or they were evil beings, and that if I didn't cooperate, they would do, you know, devil things to me, okay?
Right, right.
So in those early years, I knew it was BS, and I shook off all of those screen imagings. And see, that was another thing I think that made it for myself, this interaction and the memory was, I just took the stand that no matter what they dished out, it was a pack of lies, and it was technology. So I was able to shake off a lot of the screen imaging. So I think it made it a challenge for them. Not to say that everybody, not to say nobody else can do this. Lots of people can do this. It just so happened that I was at the wrong time at the wrong place, or one might say the right time at the right place,
right,
to be able to interact this way. So the way I see God and God's creations personally, it's man who puts a limit or a cap on what God has created. And to go out past the globe and to go out past the solar system and the universe and other dimensions, if there is a supreme being, and then it's us who puts a limit on what this individual can do. So to answer your question, no, I haven't really divulged or dabbled in that one too deeply, that aspect of it.
Okay, well, it sounds to me as though you presented an unusual challenge to them, and I think that's why they kept bringing you back. That, and perhaps they found you uniquely qualified to carry the message they wanted carried.
I apparently, and another reason, I seem to be comfortable with this, even though, and interestingly enough, you couldn't have picked a guy, particularly in the beginning, that could absolutely not have any interest in this, in alien phenomena or expressing it through the media or anything of that nature. And whatever motivated them to go to someone like me, I'm not sure, but except for one aspect of it, which is I do know that they do track and they do trace genetic family lines from the beginning. And that was shown to me more than once. And so it could be, I know they followed my family line all the way back to when we were these monkey-like creatures. So.
Did you ever get the feeling, Jim, that they are tracking us because they created us? Or,
yes.
or converse, was that a yes?
Yes. Yes, I was not sure if I shared that experience with you on the last show regarding the different scenes where we kept going back in time. Did I?
Not that I recall, no.
Okay, there was a particular session where I was cooperated and did really well and had learned some symbols highly efficiently, and I knew I was in for basically whatever I wanted for that reward session. And so my question was, and I wanted it in a question, didn't want euphoria, didn't want the sexual energy, didn't want any of that mess, just wanted to know, why me? Since it seemed to be a lot about myself when I was there.
Right.
Being selfish, but I couldn't help it. Why me? And there a hologram appeared, which was one of a World War II scene with Nazi Germans and Italian allies.
All right, very short on time.
Okay. I hear music in the background. So in one of the...
That means we're short on time. All right, hold it right there, Jim. Jim Sparks is my guest, and I doubt you've really heard anything ever quite like this. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Creation, pretty sensitive topic. Did they make us? Is that why we're being tracked? Is that why we're being experimented with, tampered with, perhaps improved, perhaps not? That's one whale of a question. Jim Sparks, back in a moment. Well, all right, Jim, I don't want to push on this, but obviously it's of high interest to many people and would explain the motivation for so much of what they're doing. It is your belief, maybe your personal belief, not based on anything specifically said to you or based on something specifically said to you, that they are indeed our creators.
Well, they showed it that way, and I didn't know where it was leading. The things that play with your on your emotions and that play on your mind and where they're going with something, and you're trying to read into where it's, what they're doing or what's the point. And in this particular scenario, it was pretty clear. And then they coupled it with saying something. But it, the first scene, it was the way that it just leads to it. The first scene was a World War II scene where there were Nazi and Italian soldiers. They were the Axis power, and it was a war-torn area, and there were two officers with a war map and other soldiers guarding the a building that had been torn up in this whole torn-up city or town or village, and they were reviewing their next plan. And as I looked close at this hologram, I could see that one of the faces of the two guys looked a lot like myself, a family member. I later learned that that through my father, that during World War II, my father fought for the United States. He was in the Army, but he had family in Italy that fought for the Axis power because they were part of that country and they didn't have any choice. So I was looking at something that was pretty realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And then another scene appeared, and it was... there is a German influence in this thing, too. I've gone off the beat here a little bit, but over the years with this, I have picked up and seen individuals from the World War II Nazi period that I could see. I'll get flashes and glimpses of those individuals or Nazi individuals who were fooling around with the ability to be in other dimensions. And there seems to be a code about the technology that enables one to go into these other dimensions that no matter what you are or who you are, once you're there, they don't meddle in anybody else's affairs. It's like a neutral ground once they're there, what goes on behind other dimensions. That's a subject for another time, maybe, but yes. I have seen that in that influence. I've seen men from 50, 60, 70 years ago who were alive and well and still in those dimensions and dimensions, and apparently they don't age.
Okay. Well, I guess I would ask this. With regard to the creation,
yeah.
Why would you necessarily buy the images or whatever they said to you on that subject any more than you did some of the early attempts to manipulate you with religious image?
Well, we were progressing, so to speak, or I was, I should say.
Right.
To where I was playing along with the game and the game plan, and I started seeing real value in what these guys were and what these guys were doing, and what I maybe not necessarily what they had to offer, but I could get real knowledge and real gain out of it. And the games that they had played, and the mind games, projecting thoughts and projecting other realities that I could shake off. I just learned how to shake those things off over the years, to where it got into a point where now I can gain some realistic or some real reality out of what I was seeing. Hey, again, if there's a mind that's capable of 100 times the speed, sure, anybody can be fooled. Anybody can be deceived. But as from what I could tell over the years, I'm seeing things progress in a way that's more positive and real relative to interaction with these guys, and a lot of it has to do with some of the things I started seeing. I'm not saying that I accepted it, but I could see reality there. And the next scene was a that was a good question. Excuse me. The next scene was a turn of the century scene, Industrial Revolution period, and I could see a ribbon cutting ceremony, and then I saw an individual that was a family member or looked a lot like myself. So I was getting the picture, okay? So what they were describing was how they tracked this particular
sure.
family line, myself. The scene, then that disappeared, and another scene, fascinating stuff to look at when you look at this stuff, because you know you're looking at something from that time period, and it's unlike what you see in the movies or anything like that. It's just the real thing. And you're looking at the next one was the early medieval period where a bunch of fellows were sitting around a wooden table in a medieval inn, and they were drinking out of wooden goblets, and one of them was toasted, and that was me, very drunk, or a family member of mine. And then another scene appeared, and it was, and I'll skip through a couple of them. The last one before the very last one that appeared was during the Roman period, I would say, best from what I could tell, for anywhere from 1 to 300 A.D., and it was centered around the Senate, the Roman Senate, and I'm not saying that I was a member of the Senate, but I was in a crowd, or not myself, but a family member, and I could see the family resemblance in a crowd on the bleachers during a debate. So early democracy, so to speak. Now the
well, that's not going back to creation, but it's pretty early. Jim, I've got to stop you there, and if I don't take a couple of calls, they'll string me up.
Okay,
David in Newport Beach, you're on with Jim Sparks.
Hi, Art and Jim.
My Hi.
Wife was studying tonight for a test in anthropological biology at Orange Coast College, which is a local college here in Southern California. And she was explaining to me how humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes. And I said to her, well, what about star children or indigo children? You know, these kids that are super smart and have blue eyes and old souls. And she wasn't really familiar with the concept, so I asked her to ask her professor, who she has not had the chance to ask. So I'm asking you, do these kids have something extra? Is there something different about their DNA? Is it somehow altered?
Okay, it's a good question for you, Jim. Do you know a thing about it?
Well, I do know that there's an insurance policy out there that they're creating hybrid human beings, one of which came from me, and that's another story in itself, where I saw something akin to what was supposed to be my daughter, and from semen extracted from myself, who the over-volunteer was, I have no clue, or non-volunteer, and this person was a cross between human beings, and I've seen them between human beings and ETs with complete telepathic ability, frailer in form, more environmentally concerned, much higher intelligence, and less having emotions, but less emotions than we generally do. Something that would be more environmentally fit for the planet itself.
Okay. Michael in Indio, California, you're on with Jim.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Arbel.
Hi.
Yeah, I do have a question regarding the origin of gray aliens, because I hear multiple theories about how they originated. I hear they either originated from Earth's past because of their resemblance to dinosaurs if they were still around, but I do have another question. I think it's more scientific. I really think that they originated from tens of thousands of years in the future from another planet or another galaxy in the universe. Do you agree with my question? And I'll hang up.
Actually, I don't. I do. I don't have a problem with that. It may be more so than the theory, because I do know for a fact, and I've seen it with my own eyes, that time travel is just something that they do commonly. And it's just simply, again, another technology. So absolutely, it's very possible.
Okay. D.C. in Boston, you're on with Jim.
Good evening or good morning. Best interview I've ever heard on Coast to Coast.
Thank you.
I'd have to say, I have a quick question. I once had sight, no longer have sight. I believe I've been deemed unusable because I no longer have the visual stimuli, unless necessary in some of the experiments. However, in my last visitation was 3 years ago. Do you think that the language of the dots and the squiggly lines can be taught to a carbon form who does not have sight?
In order to see, in order to see radar, you mean, or if you can?
No, he's not sighted. In other words, could he learn that language without having sight?
Oh yes, absolutely. Because sorry for misunderstanding that. Yes, a big part of it is three parts, which is direction, which is, in most case, was using my right forefinger up against that table. So whether my eyes are open or closed, I'm going to move in the direction of the symbol. The motion or the speed in which you move it, and sounding it out. Those are three basic essentials there for creating the symbols in your mind that are the stronger brain waves that are easier to pick up. So the answer is yes.
Okay. Danny in Reno, Nevada, your turn with Jim Sparks.
Good evening. It's always an honor to be on the show. And, well, my question was, I've had many experiences and, come to your own theories when you start to engulf in some of these, readings and some of these books that people write about abductions and their experiences. And so I've always been fascinated because I've always had some amazing experiences happen to me living in Southern California. My question is, first, have you read Philip H. Kraft's book regarding the Grays and his abduction case?
No, I have not, and there's a specific reason. I'm always tempted to go to movies. I'm always tempted to read material, but I've taken the stand 19 years ago, and it holds true today, to avoid reading other material and seeing other movies as much as I want to, so as to not cloud the experiences that I'm having. So everything that I've discussed with you is coming firsthand from the experience.
Boy, does that ever make sense to me. For that very reason, I don't listen to other talk show hosts anymore. I don't want to consciously, or worse yet, subconsciously, take anything from anybody else. And I'm sure it's very much the same with you.
Yes, it is.
Joe in Los Angeles, you're on with Jim.
Yeah, calling from East Los Angeles. I have a question. Since our planet is based on petroleum, everything, all products are made out of petroleum, and now that we know that petroleum is created in the earth, it's not something that is finite, it's something that is created in the earth. Does the grays have any production in the Middle Earth, which is hollow, I guess, and I guess that's where they live? Are they involved in the production of petroleum? Is there like some pro quo with our governments on the planet and with them that, you know, you give us petroleum, we'll give you humans or anything to that effect? Is there some manufacturing going back and forth?
I'm not aware of any interaction that way or any kind of business dealings in that respect. I do know that there is pollution-free energy. There is energy that and mechanisms that provide free energy, and I know they have been provided to us, and they're not being used, and I do know they exist, and I also know that it does come from extraterrestrial technology. In some cases, this is an extremely sensitive area to me, and perhaps maybe on another show, Art, I'll go over a gentleman that was gifted with the ability to create something like that, and his life was snuffed out. It was kind of a scary thing. So I'm familiar with mechanisms and obscene mechanisms that can create energy, but were not petroleum-based.
Okay. Dale in Buffalo, New York, you're on with Jim.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen.
Hey.
I quite frankly, I find your story a little bit lacking in credibility.
In what area?
Well, in an overall, the way one person senses another person, without any specific detail.
Strange. I find it just the opposite. But go ahead.
Yeah, and I caught that, and I laughed to myself. I said, two people could be looking at an accident and see two entirely different things. Or
apparently, you know, so. Do you have a question, though, associated with this doubt?
Well, yes, I do, in a sense. He would know, Jim would know, that there are people out here that doubt, you know, the validity of what he's saying. Why wouldn't you take the next step and go to a large ABC News or this or that, or some of the well-known investigators, and ask them to give you a battery of lie detector tests as to validate you entirely and put you above and beyond the ordinary person making these claims? And
okay, that is an entirely reasonable question. Jim,
sure,
how would you react to that?
I have no problem with the fact that, and I totally respect the fact that you have a healthy disbelief for perhaps what I have to say and the experiences I've gone through. In fact, I'm comfortable with that, and I would hope people are that way and they express it. Because I don't
would you
them.
Submit yourself to that?
Yeah, I'd have no problem with that at all.
Well, you know, you are so credible in a sense, Jim, that you may well get that offer. You really might.
I don't have a problem with it at all. And I do understand that the things that I've gone through were hard for me to accept and believe. And I'm
of
not
course.
Claiming to have all the answers. There's a lot that I know now. So I've had tomatoes and rotten eggs thrown at me.
I'm sure you have.
But I still respect it just the same. How can you blame people?
Okay. Jolanne in Minnesota, you're on with Jim Sparks. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Art. Congratulations on the baby.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask a question, but as I was listening on hold, something else also occurred to me, so it's kind of a two-parter.
Okay, well, just go ahead and ask.
First, you suggested that they created us, and yet you stayed away from the whole idea of religion, which I
probably
found very
because
weird.
Probably, ma'am, because he did go on ahead to answer the second question.
Okay. My second question would be, did they ever intimate or suggest that there was anything beyond here? Do we have spirits and souls? And when you talked about seeing yourself pass by pass by pass, how do you know that that wasn't you?
I tread dangerous territory when I talk about that, because there are those who deeply believe in reincarnation. I don't have a problem with that, but in this case, that's not what I was being shown. It was family members. Also, in the last scene, which we kind of ran out of time, they showed these ape-like creatures foraging in what looked like the African savanna. And the reason I say that is it kind of fascinated me that it was that scenery, because you could see the trees that kind of grow sideways over there that are unique to that area.
Yes.
These things looked between monkeys and people, something I've never seen on any documentary. And the message was that they had – that's why I shy away from it, because I was angry at this for a long time, not so much now. But the message from that was that they genetically altered these creatures to make what we are today. So, yes, they're claiming responsibility to a certain degree for that.
All right. Maybe we can squeeze in one more. Diane in Washington, you're on with Jim.
Yes, Art and Jim. Art, a long time ago you did a show with a guest on who simply said, if you want to go to another planet, simply ask. You remember that show?
You vaguely. I remember the question, yes.
Yeah. Well, I did it that night, and indeed I did. And long before Jim was on your show, I did travel to another planet. And, Jim, I met your was shown in three spheres by my companions, exactly who you describe. But I was not shown on the reptile ones, the bottom parts of them.
All right, I'm sorry, hon. We're out of time. Jim, what an incredible interview. Your book, of course, is The Keepers. That's the title, An Alien Message for the Human Race, The Keepers. You're going to want to grab a hold of that, Jim. We'll do another show soon.
Well, I would love to, Art. Enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on.
Take care, my friend. Good night.